Yes, what this would do is fold in the reporting of these kinds of offenses, be they crimes or non-criminal incidents, into the same reporting pattern that we collect other uniform crime reporting data. There would be a record of each incident reported, just as there is now. But
can I ask you the one key question we need to have? There will be no fiscal impact this coming biennium as a result of this bill if it's amended this way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, that's true, because we will fold this design into the redesign that we already have some federal funding for. And many of the data elements, the relationships between victims and offenders, and some of those kinds of things are already provided for in the federal requirements.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all very much. Are we going to move into work session? Are we on work session? We'll move into work session on House Bill 2993.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
I move the written up version of House Bill 2993 so as to amend the bill as a conceptual amendment, the one that changes, for instance, peace officers to law enforcement agencies, and it reads Section 1, amend ORS 181550 as shown on the attached draft.
Let's make it easy and mark what Mr. Niebel gave us as dash 1.
Dash 1.
And Representative Mannix moves the dash 1 amendments conceptually. Further discussion of that motion? Is there objection to that motion? Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
I move the bill as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Mannix moves House Bill 2993 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bell?
Aye.
Representative Mannix?
Aye.
Representative Parks?
Aye.
Representative Sinceri?
Aye.
Chair Clark?
Chair votes aye. Bill's passed the full committee due pass recommendation. Representative Parks, would you do us the honor of carrying that? Representative Mannix, thank you very much. Do a good speech.
Yes, sir.
We will move into public hearing on House Bill 2994.
You might let folks know that Representative Mason is out there in reserve.
Yeah, Representative Mason is doing reapportionment battles and is available if we need him for a vote. So, thanks, Kim. Council, would you give us, please, remind us kind of the provisions of this bill? And while you're doing that, I'm going to ask Mr. Niebel to bring up requesters of the bill, whoever you want to bring up as part of your panel, so we can have a little discussion here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2994 makes some significant changes to the arrest provisions that relate to domestic violence, and also some housekeeping changes in the Family Abuse Prevention Act. I think the most significant change being requested by the proponents is the requirement that a police officer identify and arrest a person who would be known as the primary physical aggressor. The problem that's being raised in this is that oftentimes peace officers in making arrests in domestic violence situations tend to arrest both parties if they have injuries, and that is alleged to be counterproductive to the act. There are some other changes that are housekeeping. The only other one that I would note, I think, as being somewhat more policy-oriented or less housekeeping, I guess, is that there is a currently, I think, you have the ability to get neutral restraining orders, and this would eliminate that availability.
Okay. Let's let me start off with a question for anybody in the panel and ask for you to summarize and advocate for things in the bill other than the language about the primary physical aggressor. In other words, the bill has become identified with this provision, and I want to separate out that provision for a minute and talk to us about what the rest of the bill does, and so that we can kind of reach consensus on as much as we can reach consensus on, and then kind of move into the tougher parts.
Thank you, Chair Clark. I'm David Niebel, representing the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. After the primary physical aggressor language, there's another small change in Section 1 of the bill. This really is a housekeeping change. It corrects a reference to the jurisdictional limit in small claims court that's contained in a statement that's given to victims at the scene. Changes that from 700 to 2,500, which is the correct citation.
And that's not a substantive change, that's simply conformity.
That's correct.
Okay.
Section 2 of the bill does a number of things, counsel said, the most significant of which is that it deletes the authority of courts to make mutual restraining orders. Mutual orders are often entered by judges at the time that the petitioner is actually at ex parte, an ex parte hearing attempting to get a restraining order. A judge can simply check off a box on the form, on the order form, that says each party is restrained from harassing each other. Mutual orders are often also entered in the course of hearings requested by respondents on restraining orders. They're often entered as a result without any showing on the part of the respondent that the respondent is entitled to an order. In other words, the orders are often made simply to add, I suppose, some symmetry to a situation in which symmetry might not be required. There's no notice generally to the petitioner that a mutual order is even a possibility, and often there's no basic showing of entitlement.
That would not prohibit a person who on Tuesday is designated as a respondent from on Wednesday becoming a petitioner, would it?
That's correct. It would not prevent the respondent from filing his or her own proceeding. That's right. Then that resolves the due process problem because the petitioner then would have notice of what the respondent was doing. The main problem that mutual orders raise is that it chills the potential petitioner's likelihood or ability to go to court to seek the protection of the court to get a restraining order in the first place. If he or she thinks that a likely outcome could be that the judge will also order him or her restrained as well as the adverse party, they're less likely to seek the protection of the court in the first place.
Let me interject here for a minute. Doesn't it usually say, maybe it's in here, molesting, interfering with, or menacing the other? My clients that I've advised to go get a restraining order typically do not object to the idea that they can't molest, interfere, or menace the other party. I mean, help me out with what I'm struggling with.
Well, they probably don't object to that, but the effect of having that embodied in an order is that if they seek the protection of law enforcement to enforce their side of the order, the possibility of a mutual arrest or just a single arrest is raised, and also there's always the possibility out there that the respondent could, out of the blue or for good or bad reasons, whatever, for bad reasons, might call the peace officers and have the restraining order enforced against the petitioner. The Multnomah County family law judges have taken the approach to simply strike that part of the order from their form. So they're no longer issuing mutual restraining orders at all. And the handout that Judge Harrell referred to, or the work that Judge Harrell referred to in his testimony on the previous bill, recommendations from the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, a report called Family Violence, Improving Court Practice. The Family Violence Project came out strongly in opposition to the practice of granting mutual restraining orders. And I've got copies of that report for the committee. It's not the full report. It's got the table of contents and a preface in it, and it's got the relevant page. The most relevant page is the last one, which is marked as page 20.
Okay. Let me work you on through the bill, Mr. Newbold. Page 3, basically all the stuff about the forms then modifies the restraining order form to comply with that change. Is that right?
Yes, that this particular change occurs on page 2, lines 37 and 38.
Right.
Deletes the authority of the court, and on page 6 at lines 5 and 6, it deletes the provision of the form providing for the mutual order.
Okay.
The next change is found on page 9 at line 19. At present, restraining orders are served either by the sheriff or by a private party that the petitioner elects. There's no provision allowing a municipal peace officer to make service of a restraining order. In some circumstances, it makes sense to enable a municipal peace officer to do that. The situation might be, for example, where the petitioner has gotten a restraining order, has taken it to the sheriff to have served. The sheriff has not served it yet. The respondent comes to the petitioner's place and begins to harass the petitioner. The petitioner calls the municipal police officers. They respond and are on the scene. The petitioner says, well, I've got this restraining order. It's not yet been served on the respondent. It would simply be convenient, and it certainly just makes sense at that point for the municipal peace officer to take a copy of the restraining order and serve it on the respondent.
Okay, let me stop you there and ask at least one of my concerns. Most county sheriff's offices, or all of them, are set up with process-serving units or process-serving capacities that are used to it. I don't know that municipal police agencies are. And my question is there some language that we can adopt to amend the bill that's brought to us to clarify that that's the circumstance you're talking about? Because the way it reads right now, it says the county sheriff shall serve unless the petitioner elects to have respondent served personally by a private party or municipal police officer. So if I'm the petitioner and for whatever reason I elect that I'd like the Portland police officer to serve that, the way the bill is written right now, I can make that election, even if it's not the scenario you're discussing, and the Portland Police Department, who has, as far as I know, has no particular expertise, or I mean, they just don't do that, has to go do that. And I don't have a problem with the scenario you outlined. It makes a whole lot of sense to be able to do it under that scenario, but maybe I'm misreading the language, but it appears to me that the petitioner would have the sole election there. And I don't know that we want to sort of start requiring police officers to serve restraining orders as a matter of course, not in the narrow circumstances you're talking about.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to attempt to come up with some clarifying language on that, because it is not our intent to make this the normal method of service.
It's probably doable to come up with some language to outline your scenario, I think. Might be tortured, but I think we could probably do it. Okay.
We'll take a run at it.
We'll torture away. All right.
The last change that the bill makes is to the section of the restraining order statute that sets forth how a respondent requests a hearing. Under present law, the law simply says the respondent may request a court hearing upon any relief granted, period. The problem is that when the petitioner finds out that the respondent has requested a hearing, the petitioner often doesn't have any idea what the respondent is objecting to, whether it's visitation, whether it's custody, whether it's property, what have you. Our intent on this section of the bill is simply to have the respondent specify what it is he or she is objecting to, and to articulate that so that the petitioner can prepare for the hearing. There is a provision that says that the last provision of the bill says that the hearing won't be limited to the issues raised in the respondent's request for a hearing, simply because the respondent, we don't hold the respondent to be legally correct and formal, but if the respondent does raise issues that weren't raised in the request for a hearing, the petitioner can get a continuance for the purpose of preparing a response. This is a concept that's taken from the FED statute, the Forcible Entry and Detainer statute.
Do we need that last sentence? I mean, doesn't a judge have the authority to do that anyway? I mean, I guess my concern is it may not be necessary to have a continuance, and it says shall. See my point? I mean, I can technically, you could have an issue not raised in the request for a hearing form. The petitioner may not need a continuance, and yet the statute says that you get one.
Well, I believe that our intent here is that the petitioner would get one if he or she requests it. I don't think it would be automatic that if a issue were raised that was beyond the scope of the hearing request, that automatically meant that
How about for good cause shown or something that the petitioner shall be entitled to reasonable continuance? So that there has to be some. I don't want to monkey with the language too much. I'm just, you'd like the judge to be able to deal with the matter when it's in front of him or her, if it's doable at that point.
I agree, Chair Clark, that's right. But I also think that what this is intended to do is to prevent something getting sprung on someone in open court. We're usually talking about a proceeding in which they're just the two parties before the court, and probably very nervous and probably not very well acquainted with what their options may be.
I don't want to get hung up on that, but I may want to look at some way to take that up a little bit. Okay, well, that walks us through the bill. Questions for Mr. Niebel on kind of that overview of the bill? Appreciate you doing that for us. Either Ms. Armada or Ms. Pruitt, if you have anything further to add to that. Okay, now, before we go to other witnesses and all that, let's dialogue for a little bit about Section 1, because that at least has me concerned, and I think it has some of the other members concerned as well. And I think you understand our basic worry about this. Mine, anyway, is that I'm not sure that it's not requiring a peace officer to be a kind of peace officer and judge at the same time. I wonder whether it's workable for a peace officer to show up and determine who is the primary physical aggressor. I wonder whether it will pass the House floor, but that's a separate issue. So can we get you to advocate for Section 1 a little bit and invite other members of the committee to join in the questioning? Because I don't think the concerns are limited to me.
Chair Clark, I want to respond in a couple ways. First of all, we copied some materials for the committee's edification. There is a reprint from the Harvard Women's Law Journal from an issue in 1988 that talks about mandatory arrest in general and talks particularly on page 225 to 226 about the mutual arrest problem in particular. I'm also distributing a handout, the top sheet of which is a letter from Judge Stephen Clough or Clough in Evergreen District Court in Washington about how the primary physical aggressor language has worked in Washington. There are also included in that packet other materials on how what practice is in Washington, the last page of which is their statute, their mandatory arrest and primary physical aggressor statute. We have as witnesses two peace officers who might speak to some of the committee's concerns about whether this bill asks them to do too much when they're on the scene of a domestic disturbance. And perhaps their testimony might be most edifying to the committee in considering this issue.
Great. Questions for this panel of witnesses before we hear from the peace officers? Representative Parks.
Just for a minute, assume that we took out all this language about primary physical aggressor. What are we left with in that? If that's in the first part, what happens? What's the practical effect on the first page?
Representative Parks, the practical effect would be the law as it is now. I believe, yeah.
I forgot actually what we talked. I know we talked about this in my office before and everything, but the intent of the law is to prevent victims of domestic violence from continuing abuse. Right, and that's the intent of the law in all our laws. So why is that in the bill? There's got to be a reason. Why is that in this bill? Why do you want it in there?
Well, Representative Parks, that is in the bill. That's one of the criteria that a peace officer uses to determine primary physical aggressor, and the intent of the law is, and in determining whether or which party, whether to make an arrest or which party to arrest, the peace officer should take that into account.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Parks, Judith Armada for the record. The purpose of that particular statement is that this law, the mandatory arrest law, is a unique law. And so when the legislature passed it, it passed it because of a particular societal problem, which was that domestic violence perpetrators were not being arrested at all. And so the legislature mandated arrest. And when we talk about the intent of the law to protect victims of domestic violence, that's what we mean. This particular law, in its unique circumstances, the legislature really intended at this place to not treat this as a domestic spat. The legislature intended that you treat this as a criminal problem and that there is a perpetrator and there's a victim in most cases.
If I might continue for just a minute.
Representative Parks.
I really have a lot of problems with the bill, frankly. And somebody's organized a very good campaign of people calling my office from Klamath Falls, which is not usual. But they happen to be from a lot of people that I really respect their judgment, and so it's caused me quite a bit of concern. I am not unsympathetic to your position here, but I'm really concerned that we have a response that leads us, and I'm not quite as emphatic as Representative Mason, but does lead to almost inevitably we arrest the man. And I know that'll cure the problem for that night, but I'm not so sure that's the right way to do it. And that's what my concern is. This almost says that you arrest the man. It really does.
I would really like the subcommittee to hear from Stan Robson on that point, and maybe okay. the other officer who's also here, because he's worked in this field for so long, and he can explain. He told me this afternoon of some situation that was an appropriate one, and you know, why does it mean that always the man will be arrested? I don't think that it does, but I do think, and I would like to emphasize this, that in addressing the problem of domestic violence, we tend to want to sidestep one of the tragedies. And that tragedy is that it is mostly perpetrated by men on women. I think that it, in order to address that problem, that we need to face up to that fact, regret it, and try to do something about it. But, you know, this is saying there is a primary aggressor, and let's look at who that could be. It could be the woman. It could be a woman.
But, you know, if you follow your logic, almost everybody charged with a crime is guilty. I mean, they really are. I know that, and you have to be dumb not to know that if you work in it. Almost everyone is guilty. And then we could right. eliminate no, I think, a lot by just saying the police officers are good, decent people trying to do the right thing, and we'd save $300 million in the state in a biennium by not having criminal trials. It's to protect. I don't want to get on a soapbox. That's my concern.
It's to protect the occasional.
That's right.
And I would just like to add further that it says to the police officer, you must do an investigation here, and you must make an arrest, and it doesn't preclude the district attorney from filing charges against the other party at a later date. You know, it just says do a good investigation at this point.
The one other thing is I wanted to hear your explanation again, Mr. Niebuhr, about the mutual restraining orders. If I don't want you to bother me and I go to court and say, don't call me up, don't bother me, then why do you care if it's a mutual thing? If I can't call you, why should you be able to call me or contact me or harass me? Why is that understand that?
Representative Parks, I don't think that it's our intent to say that the other person is allowed to harass or call or make the other person's life miserable. It's certainly not our intent to protect the petitioner if there are grounds for a restraining order to be issued against the petitioner.
Let me ask you to reemphasize, too, that nothing in this bill precludes the respondent from going right back in and asking for a restraining order the other way.
That's correct.
But it gets, to me, it's almost like a game. I got a restraining order, you know? See what I mean? What is the point? If you want to keep the people apart, if you don't want them harassing, why should either one of them contact them, and why should it even be an issue?
Well, Representative Parks, I believe that, you know, the problem is that we've got the system set up that people are allowed to have notice before the court takes action against them. And I think that notice and you know, an opportunity to present your side of the story, or at least have the other side present the facts that would give the basis for a particular kind of relief, that's just sort of basic due process. Also, I think that the problem is the problem that people have when there is a mutual order entered against them is that they are less likely to seek the protection of the system when they actually need it, because they're afraid that they'll be in a mutual arrest, or that you know, out of the blue they'll be arrested on a complaint from the other party.
I can see that last argument a little bit. Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Okay, Representative 3.
Well, I have some concerns with it, too. I have tried to, I've read this over several times, and I am not able to get to it and be comfortable. We're mandating an officer to go in and make an arrest. He's got to go in and make an arrest. And some of the things that he's required to do here, I just don't think it's possible for a police officer to do in the situation. I've ridden along on several and gone into some of these.
Representative, sorry, let me ask Mr. Robson to come up and respond
Fine.
In part to your questions.
Fine.
I want, and Mr. Bowler. And I think the witnesses understand why I want to do that. Okay. Go ahead with your question. I'm sorry.
Well, not always, but often there's a great deal of chaos going on when one of these things transpires and you've got neighbors in there or relatives in there that have been called in or something before the police get there. And I think there's a real problem in requiring an officer to, first of all, line 21 talks about the comparative extent of the injuries inflicted. I think it's almost impossible for a police officer to determine what the extent of the injuries. They could be internal injuries and not know that. Even a doctor wouldn't be able to find that out. So to require that of an officer, I think, is probably taking it too far. I don't think it's possible for an officer to be able to sit down to research the history of the domestic violence. I mean, what is he going to go to the neighbors? Is he going to try to talk to relatives? How is he going to get solid information from either one of the people that have just been beating on each other? I think it's impractical to put the officer in that position. And the idea of the potential for future assaults, I don't see how he can make an adequate judgment. Now, you know, if this has happened the last two weekends, the potential of it maybe going to happen tomorrow night again is is certainly possible, but to make any kind of an adequate judgment for potential future assaults, I don't know that he could do that. At least to put him on that in that position at the time, I just think it's unfair to the police officer.
Chair Clark, Representative Censuri, and other members. I'm Stan Robson. I'm Chief Criminal Deputy at Benton County Sheriff's Department and been in law enforcement just over 20 years. Worked the road, worked investigation for 14 years, and now an administrator. Your concerns are valid, and in my response to what you're saying here, I also take some exception in the checklist of how you do this. I think what it is an attempt to identify how a police officer should investigate the particular case. I do support this bill, however, in that I do think that when we go back at the purpose of the act to begin with, the Abuse Prevention Act, is that unfortunately law enforcement did not look at domestic violence as a serious matter, did not like interfering with family matters, so to speak, taking a stand when they got to a domestic complaint and doing anything that maybe negotiating a bit, trying to get one party or the other to leave in kind of a Band-Aid effect. And because there wasn't good objective investigation of these types of activities,